Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California. I'm Frank Price, Advocacy Partner of the National Peace Corps Association and Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Member-Led Forum. I want to thank all of you for coming here tonight. When Linda Calhoun, who is not here tonight, the Chair of the International Relations Member-Led Forum, recommended that I contact Adele about her recent book on demography, a topic that always has interested me, I was eager to have a program with her. I read the opening sentence, and it grabbed my attention as if I were starting an adventure novel. She wrote, "We are in uncharted demographic territory across the globe." That just resonated inside me. Adele and I have had several important, detailed, and lengthy conversations in great about this program. Because demography is uncharted waters for many, can have land and water, I believe it is far better format for her to tell her story first before the questions are asked. There will be 15 minutes toward the end of the hour for you to ask questions, and then I'll walk around with the microphone. I have questions that I'm going to ask her as well. So without further ado, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Adele. Adele Hayton is a business economist specializing in comparative international demographics. She is currently an Annenberg Distinguished Visiting Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Building on her experience in business and academia, Dr. Hayton has developed an innovative comparative perspective that highlights surprising demographic differences across countries and illustrates the unprecedented speed and impact of critical changes. You are now in for an interesting and informative world tour.
So I'm really thrilled to be here tonight, and I thank Carol for promoting my topic as well. And it's really nice to see so many familiar faces. So thank you all for coming. As Frank said, I'm going to be taking you on a world tour of population change, and I'll demonstrate that we are in uncharted territory. You'll learn about some of the dramatic consequences that are currently unfolding, including China's stunning demographic plunge and Africa's population explosion. I'll also show you where declining birth rates lead to shrinking populations and shrinking workforces, where aging populations strain economic well-being, and where immigration is key for ensuring continued economic growth. We are in for some stunning demographic changes. Key to understanding these changes is addressing several common misconceptions about demography. One myth is that population trends are slow-moving. That may have been true in the past and may still be the case in some places, but in many countries, these supposedly slow-moving trends are rapidly accelerating and combining in ways that produce dramatic changes around the world. A second common misconception is that countries follow similar patterns of demographic transition as they develop economically or move from youthful to aging societies. This gives rise to the idea of age waves, with countries all following a similar pattern one after another. That might lead you to believe, as some observers have said, that today's mature economies will soon become like Japan, or that Mexico will follow the trends in Brazil, or that India will be like China. This is far from reality, and I will show you that the key to understanding and adapting to the coming changes is to recognize that the timing and pace and magnitude of change varies greatly across countries. This variation stems from the underlying demographic drivers, which differ dramatically across the globe. A third misconception is that long-term projections are not reliable because there are so many uncertainties shaping economic and social trends. Some demographers think that given these uncertainties, it is irresponsible to look too far into the future. Well, I take the opposite view. I think it's irresponsible not to consider a long horizon. We have long-term projections, and we should use them. Yes, there may be greater uncertainty the longer your view, but if you take a long view and consider alternative scenarios, then you can explicitly consider the uncertainties and bracket possible outcomes. So here's my plan for the next 40 minutes or 45 minutes. I'll first illustrate how population growth will be uneven across geographic regions and countries. Then I'll show you how key drivers, including declining fertility and increasing life expectancy, contribute to the uneven growth. Then I'll highlight how these drivers combine to create specific demographic challenges. Before I start the tour, I want to tell you about my general approach to thinking about population trends, population changes across countries, and how I address these misconceptions. First, I explain changes using a comparative framework because I find it easier to understand the important changes in one country compared to what is happening somewhere else. That way, you can see differences in the speed and timing of the changes. Such a comparative perspective will show you that many countries you might have thought were similar will follow divergent paths. Second, I do take a long perspective to show how short-term changes contribute to the longer-term outcomes. I will show you that if you don't take a long perspective, you might completely miss and be unprepared for future trends we know are coming. Third, I will show you how demographic changes are shaping world events. I do this by linking news headlines to demographic trends. As we all see, a regular flood of economic and political news, including headlines about economic growth, investment trends, healthcare, pension reform, European energy demand, and Russian military strategy, just to name a few. Much of this news is rooted in demographics. By that, I mean it's rooted in issues involving changing populations of specific countries or the changing age mix within a country. You might not even realize that many of the headlines you read every day are linked to demographics, but let me assure you, demographics affects all aspects of our lives, from our housing and job choices to economic growth and national security. You'll see this in the news if you look beyond the headlines, behind the headlines. Here's a sampling of news headlines you might have seen. The first group tells how various countries are responding to their labor shortages. Russia raises conscription age as fighting intensifies in Ukraine. Germany invests to prolong employees' working lives. South Korea needs foreign workers, but often fails to protect them. Japan's labor market has a lesson for the Fed. Women can surprise you. America's choice, immigration or bust. The second group highlights societal concerns stemming from demographic change. China's collapsing birth and marriage rates reflect deep pessimism. Aging baby boomers raise the risk of long-term care crisis in the United States. A frenzy of innovation in obesity drugs is underway. And finally, we have two overall assessments. Forbes says we have a forever labor shortage. And The Economist says the combination of demographics, technology, and public policy will transform how labor markets work and create a golden age for workers. We are indeed in uncharted demographic territory in at least five ways. First, across the globe, some populations are starting to shrink and others are growing explosively. Second, the world has more old people than ever before, and fewer children are being born. Third, many countries already have more old people than children. Fourth, with fewer children being born, the pipeline of workers is shrinking. Fifth, workforce growth is slowing almost everywhere and actually reversing in many places. These trends in population change and age mix have enormous implications for economic growth and stability, as well as for national security. The good news is that we have some reliable tools and forecasts that can guide us through this uncharted territory. The UN population projections we will see here provide guideposts and warnings and can help us identify the questions and uncertainties we need to address. The population projections are like maps. They will help us navigate a new demographic world. Of course, there are many uncertainties, and we will want to consider alternative scenarios to help bracket the possible outcomes so we can adapt our strategies accordingly. If we use the projections, we can have a clear view of future population trends. Demography gives us a window on the future, and once we understand the future, we can chart precise navigation strategies. So, with that in mind, we will start with this long-term view of population growth. According to the UN's most likely scenario, global population will reach nearly 10 billion by 2050, up from 8 billion today. While the total increase is important, the regional distribution of growth is particularly consequential. As shown on this slide, the big news is that Africa, shown in orange at the top of the chart, accounts for almost all future growth. You can see that Africa has grown from a sliver of world population to a large and growing share of it, expanding to 1.3 billion in 2020. Due to continued high fertility, Africa's population is projected to nearly double to 2.5 billion by 2050 and grow to 4.3 billion by century end. This means that Africa's total population will increase by about 3 billion by century end, accounting for nearly all the global increase. With this increase, Africa's share of world population will grow from 17% in 2020 to nearly 40%, 17% in 2020 to nearly 40% by 2100. So, in contrast to Africa's steep increase, Asia, shown in yellow, will experience an arc of growth. Its population will peak around mid-century and then decline. You can see it will end the century at a level close to today's population. Like Asia, Latin America will see continued population growth through mid-century, then decline as the impact of low fertility sets in. North America, shown in light blue, is projected to see continued slow growth, largely due to immigration. In contrast, Europe's population, shown in gray at the bottom, is already declining due to decades of low fertility and aging populations. The concentration of growth in Africa is particularly challenging because it means that most population growth will be in low-income, least developed countries, countries that are least prepared to deal with growth. At the same time, the large numbers, if leveraged, can provide significant opportunities for economic growth and improved well-being. Before I go on, I just want to say a few words about these slides and the data. So even though each chart contains a lot of data, the main thing to notice now is the shape. You can always find the specific information later. I use the United Nations projections, and as I mentioned, I take a long perspective to show how today's changes differ from the past and how they fit in the long-term picture. Most of my charts present data from 1950 through 2100. And to underscore the timing of key changes, the charts include vertical markings at 2020, you can barely see that here, and 2050. That makes it easy to see what's expected over the next 30 years as well as the long term. The shape in this chart representing total population tells you that the total curve is becoming less steep. Total growth is slowing overall, but as you can see, growth is uneven across the regions. There are some striking differences within each region, and I will highlight some of these. So this slide shows the 10 most populous African countries. It shows their diverse growth patterns. The main thing to notice is the size and growth of Nigeria, shown in yellow at the top. I'm sorry that the yellow is kind of pale, but you can see it. Already the most populous country in Africa, Nigeria soars way past all the others. I included the United States on this slide to put Nigeria's growth in perspective. The U.S. is the gray line, the second one down. The projection of Nigeria, currently 200 million, Nigeria is projected to double by 2050. The next 30 years, it's going to double, 200 to 400. And it will, by during that time, it will surpass the U.S. The projection to over 700 million by century end reflects the projection that fertility rates will remain high, even though they will be lower than today. A second important characteristic of Africa's growth is that nearly half the population gain over the next 30 years is projected to occur in just six countries, starting from the top, including Nigeria, DRC, Ethiopia, Tanzania, Egypt, and Angola, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the big one in the middle. The rapid population growth in these large countries poses both huge challenges as well as opportunities for economic growth. So it will be increasingly important to more fully understand the strengths and weaknesses of these individual countries. So now turning to Asia, I couldn't resist putting Africa on this chart with India and China. So you can see Africa's total population is now about the size of China's, but will soon soar way past the 1.5 billion mark. The contrast between China and India shown here will be increasingly important, and we should all be paying attention to this. We've all heard the recent news that China's population is already declining due to its low fertility rate and increasing number of deaths. According to some forecasts, China's decline over the coming decade will be even steeper than shown here. In contrast, India's population is projected to continue growing for another 40 years before peaking. Many countries have an arc of population growth closer to China's than India's, and many will see population decline starting within the next few decades. We'll see this as we turn to Latin America. So this slide shows the arc of population growth differs across Latin America's most populous countries. For Brazil, the arc of population decline is steep, while for Mexico, and the population decline will start later and be more gradual. Like Brazil and Mexico, most countries in Latin America will face some population decline after mid-century. Argentina and Guatemala are exceptions to this pattern and are expected to see continued population growth. Okay, now that we've seen how total population is expected to change around the world, we can turn to understanding the question of what is driving the differential growth rates. To do this, we look closely at two key drivers of population change: declining fertility rates and increasing life expectancy. First, we'll look at fertility. And by fertility, I don't mean ability to reproduce. I mean the number of children per woman. It's a measure akin to family size. The global decline in fertility rate, or births per woman, is one of the most transformative developments of the past century. Declining fertility rates have dramatically slowed population growth, and by reducing the number of children, these lower fertility rates have substantially altered the global age mix. Lower fertility rates over time contribute to the overall shift to older age brackets and a higher share of old people, and as we will see in many places, a declining share of working age population. Fertility rate is the standard indicator of whether a population is growing, declining, or replacing itself. Statistically, replacement rate fertility is 2.1 births per woman. If a woman has two children, she will be replacing herself and her mate. The additional fraction reflects that not all infants survive birth. So these two maps show the dramatic changes in fertility over the past 55 years, starting with 1965, which was the peak year for global fertility. In 1965, almost all countries had high fertility rates, shown in red and orange. Low fertility rates, shown in blue, you can barely see it on the top map, occurred only in a few European countries and in Japan. Now, the 2020 fertility map at the bottom looks dramatically different. Low fertility is no longer just a Japanese or European phenomena, but occurs widely around the world. Shades of blue show that low fertility rates occur in all regions except Africa. As of 2020, half the world's population lives in low fertility countries. Regionally, we see that North America and Europe are now solidly blue, with below replacement rate fertility. Latin America and Asia each have a combination of low and intermediate fertility rates, with the highest fertility rates, red and orange, remaining concentrated in Africa. Many related factors have contributed to the global fertility decline. Family planning efforts during the 1960s and 70s and the provision of contraceptives were extremely effective. In addition to improvements in reproductive health and education, girls' education has been especially critical. Another important impetus for fertility decline is economic development. As societies become more industrialized and less agrarian, fewer children are needed to support a family's livelihood. Then, as countries continue to modernize and more women become economically empowered, the economics of child-rearing change again. In many cases, this further reduces the desired number of children. Because our focus is on how individual countries evolve and adapt, we will now zoom in and look more closely at a sampling of countries with varied fertility patterns. So starting at the bottom, you see three of the world's largest economies, the U.S., Japan, and Germany. All had post-World War II baby booms, but have had below replacement rate fertility for several decades. Even though the rates have ticked up a bit, they remain below replacement rate, shown here by the dashed gray line. The three countries in the middle of the chart have experienced large fertility declines, but you can see how they differ in when the decline started and how fast the declines occurred. These differences in timing and pace give rise to the uneven population growth I showed before. China's fertility fell below replacement around 1995 after a steep decline, while India's fertility decline has been smoother and more gradual. These differences have different consequences for each country and have resulted in divergent population growth rates and age structures. Most notably, as I showed in the earlier chart, China's population has already begun declining, while India's will continue to grow. Also, China is now one of the fastest aging countries, while India remains relatively young. I want to specifically talk about China's one-child policy here. Although China is well known for its one-child policy, what is less well known is that China's fertility rate had already been steeply declining, well below the policy well before the policy came into effect in 1980. You can see this. As you can see in the chart, in just 10 years, China's fertility rate had already dropped from 6 in 1970 to 3 in 1980, when the one-child policy was adopted. They had already dropped by half. Prior to imposing the one-child restrictions, China had adopted various family planning programs, including just a campaign called Late, Long, and Few, suggesting later age of first birth, longer time in between births, and fewer births overall. The program spurred the steep fertility decline that you see that began in the 1970s. But the one-child policy was adopted in 1980, reflecting fear that population growth was still too fast, even though fertility had already steeply declined. More on that in a minute. But in the meantime, Nigeria and DRC at the top of the chart are examples of countries with extremely high fertility rates and divergent patterns of decline. While their fertility rates have recently declined, these two countries rank among the top 10 highest fertility countries. Now, although fertility rate is a useful benchmark for comparing countries, you have to remember that it may take a generation or two for the impact of a fertility decline to take effect. This depends on the current age of the population. So in a relatively young country such as China was in the 1960s, with a large proportion of women of childbearing age, the total population could continue to grow long after fertility falls to 2.1 births per woman. The average family size could be 2.1, but you have more families because you have this higher number of potential mothers. That explains why youthful countries with a steep fertility decline might continue to see population growth rates continue. China is a good example of what is called population momentum. Despite the steep drop in fertility you see here, remember starting in 1980, the one-child policy, but it was only last year, more than 40 years later, after the one-child policy was adopted, that China's population started declining. This is a full generation after fertility rate fell below replacement rate, and nearly two full generations since the one-child policy was adopted. Okay, so the three fertility patterns shown in this chart are linked to three broad demographic groups, and this is kind of how I think of the world in these three groups. First are the high-income countries that have had a long history of below replacement fertility and now face shrinking workforces and aging populations. The second group includes middle-income countries, lower middle and upper middle, that have had large fertility declines since the 60s and now have fertility near replacement rate. Many countries in this group had extremely steep fertility declines that are already showing up in shrinking workforces. In other countries, the declines were more gradual. The third group at the top includes the least developed countries, mostly low-income countries, mostly in Africa, where fertility rates, although declining, are still very high, where population growth remains explosive. Okay, so now we've looked at declining fertility, we'll move to the second driver, increasing life expectancy. These maps show the dramatic increase throughout the world. In 1955, shown at the top, the highest life expectancy of 72 years occurred in just five countries in Northern Europe. Again, you can barely see the blue. Five countries had higher than 72 years: Norway, Sweden, Denmark, the Netherlands, and Iceland. In the bottom map, as of 2020, relatively high life expectancies had spread throughout the world. More than 30 countries, mostly in Europe and East Asia, saw 2020 life expectancies of more than 80 years, the darkest blue. And more than half of all countries in the world had life expectancy of more than 70. The lowest life expectancies continue to be concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa. Looking at individual countries, you can see that life expectancy has been increasing almost everywhere, even though the pace of change differed, with some having steep gains and others having more gradual gains. This figure shows some differences across countries of particular interest, but you can see the general trend is upward. The already high life expectancy of the more developed countries at the top of the chart has steadily increased, although at different rates. Interestingly, the U.S. life expectancy grew more slowly, falling short of other industrialized countries. In contrast, many developing countries have had large and rapid gains, and most of these gains stem from basic improvements in public health, including public sanitation and better nutrition. The increase in China was especially dramatic, improving from 45 years in 1965 to 77 by 2020. You'll note that India's life expectancy, the gold line running through the middle, has improved, but not as much or as fast as China's. And then it's really, I just always find it startling, even though I've seen the number many times, it's just startling to see that Nigeria has a life expectancy of only 54 years. Now, this is a bit of an aside, but it's topical. I wanted to quickly show how life expectancy in Russia is an important exception to the global trend. And when you hear about Russia's poor demography, this is one of the things people are referring to. It's the only large economy where life expectancy so starkly deviated from the pattern of a steady increase. Life expectancy there stagnated after 1960 and then dropped after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The decline is attributed to a combination of alcohol and tobacco abuse, vodka, auto fatalities, and poor health care. It has been slowly increasing for about the last 15 years, but remains well below other European countries. And Ukraine has had a similar problem. The third population driver is international migration. International migrants, or people living outside their country of birth, have come from nearly all 200 countries, and they are hosted in nearly as many countries. Over the past 60 years, global migration has tripled, reaching over 270 million in 2019. Even though migration has been increasing, the immigrant share of world population is quite small. It's only 3.5% in 2019. But even though the share is small, the impacts on countries involved can be quite large and disruptive and controversial. Immigration is one of the most difficult variables to project, except to say that the drivers of migration are all intensifying. These drivers include the search for better economic prospects, flight from political upheaval, and flight from climate and environmental disasters. This next slide is just an example. I wanted to show the importance of immigration for the U.S., just as one example. On the left side, you see what is called the natural increase, the number of births, the dashed blue line, minus the number of deaths, the black line. So even with our low fertility rates, the number of births has been stable at around 4 million per year. But what is changing is the number of deaths. This number is projected to increase faster as the population ages. Of course, as more people reach the upper brackets, more people die. Sometimes reporters forget about the changing death rate, so news of population decline is often blamed solely on the number of births. But as you can see here on the left, the rising number of deaths plays a key role. When the lines cross, the natural increase turns negative. On the right side, you see the combination of natural increase and net migration. As the natural increase reaches zero, net migration will be the only source of population growth. In 2020, immigration accounted for about half the total population growth. According to the UN projections, by 2050, net migration will account for 90% of all growth, but only if immigration continues at the current level. Just a quick summary of the drivers I've just showed. For most countries, migration contributes only a small share of total population growth. Fertility has declined almost everywhere, and in many places is hovering below replacement rate. This eventually results in fewer children and a smaller pipeline of future workers. At the same time, we have seen increasing life expectancy almost everywhere. Some countries had large gains, while others had experienced more gradual gains. In some places, there have been temporary downturns and plateaus, but overall, the trend is generally upward. The two trends we looked at look generally smooth and gradual, and this gives rise to the claim that demographic trends move slowly. You are beginning to see that this is not true, and that such a view is dangerous, as it would keep you from preparing for the coming demographic upheaval. The challenge we face now is that the combined impact of these two drivers is leading us into uncharted territory, namely rapidly aging populations and slower growing and possibly shrinking workforces. It's as if we are smoothly sailing along a river, but up ahead there are rapids that will dramatically change our direction. The rapids are created as the underlying currents come together. As you've been hearing, in some countries the underlying currents have been gradual, and others they have been more abrupt. It is the timing and pace of these underlying currents that will determine how future population dynamics will unfold. Throughout modern history, we have gotten used to continuously growing populations, even as the age composition changed. But with fewer and fewer children, and eventually fewer workers, the celebrated gains in life expectancy are now producing a potentially more burdensome result. Not just an increasing number of old people, but an increasing proportion of older people. Population aging also leads to an increasing number of deaths. In those places where deaths exceed births, we can see shrinking total populations. So, over the next 30 years, we can expect to see shrinking total population in nearly 50 countries. Then, during the second half of the century, the number of countries with population loss will increase to more than 100. That means that nearly half of all countries are projected to have shrinking populations, even as the global population continues to grow. So what all this boils down to is rather than the continuous upward trend we were used to, for most countries, we can now expect to see an arc of growth, where total growth first slows due to fewer and fewer births, and then ultimately declines as the number of deaths exceeds births. I showed you various trajectories of total population at the beginning of my talk, and now we'll turn to specific age segments to see how the drivers combine to create these challenges. So the first challenge is population aging. So as you can see, the global population age 65 plus is projected to double by 2050, reaching 1.5 billion. China alone accounts for one quarter of the number of 65 plus. This share is higher than its 18% share of total population, but more important is that the 366 million number seems staggering to me. 366 million people 65 plus by 2050 in China. Now, as shown in the map, 2020 at the top, most countries are still relatively young, as you can see the broad swath of red and orange. That over the next 30 years, divergent patterns of aging will emerge so that by 2050, many more countries will have older populations and many fewer countries will remain young. By 2050, all the youngest countries will be found in Africa, with only a few in the Middle East and Asia. Looking at specific selected countries, we can see how the pace of aging is increasing, but differs dramatically across these countries. The speed you can see is the slope of the line. Specifically, the pace of aging or growth in the share of old people depends on how the two drivers come together to create the rapids I spoke about earlier. We'll look at a few examples, starting with the U.S., the black line running through the middle. It shows on the left at 8% in 1950. You can see this share was relatively stable until the first baby boomers started turning 65 around 2010. And then the share started increasing pretty steeply, reaching 17% in 2020 and is projected to reach 22% by 2050. But you can see it's much lower than these other countries there. So now take a look at Japan. The gray line starting at 5% in 1950 and reaching 28% in 2020. This increase, this huge, steep increase, made Japan the fastest aging population. But that distinction is now being eclipsed by South Korea, the blue line. You can see its line is much steeper, owing to its very steep fertility decline and its high life expectancy. China is also rapidly aging, and you can see it almost parallels the pattern in Japan, but is 30 years later. By mid-century, more than a quarter of China's population will be 65 and older. But in South Korea, the situation is even more extreme. By comparing the line slopes, you can see the U.S. is aging much more gradually than these other countries. Based on these projections, I calculated that China is aging three times faster than the U.S., and South Korea even faster. That means they must prepare much more quickly and develop housing, savings, and healthcare plans that are suited to the rapid increase. This is an example of an enormous change that we can see coming, which should give countries plenty of time to prepare. Okay, we've discussed aging, and now we'll turn to the second challenge, which is shrinking workforces. This chart shows that working age populations continue to grow, but the distribution across regions shifts dramatically, just as we saw before, with total population. Due to its high fertility, Africa is projected to have the fastest growing working age population and will account for three quarters of the global workforce growth over the next 30 years. In contrast, Asia's working age population is projected to peak and decline after that. As you can imagine, these different patterns of growth point to different priorities and challenges. For example, Africa faces challenges of educating, housing, and creating economic opportunities for its young growing workforce. In contrast, regions facing slower workforce growth or shrinking populations will need to alter their labor policies and business practices to leverage their existing labor supply. Expanding labor supply through greater labor force participation or immigration and adopting productivity-enhancing innovations are two general options countries have for anticipating workforce changes. So with that general overview in mind, I turn to the world's 15 largest economies. This chart sorts the 15 economies into four groups. The countries are in order of projected percentage growth, with the biggest decliners at the top. The gray bar shows the projected workforce growth over the 20 years from 2020 to 2040. And the blue bar underneath shows the subsequent 20 years. The charts show working age population. I think of this as potential workforce. Not everyone will be working, and certainly there will be people older than 64 who might also be working. So you can think of this as a rough indicator of potential labor supply. There are several things to notice about the first group at the top. Eight of the 15 largest economies, that's half the largest economies, face shrinking workforces over both 20-year periods. This points to a stark shakeup in the coming rankings of economic growth. South Korea, at 23%, faces the largest percentage decline over the next 20 years, followed by Japan, Italy, and Spain. The next largest percentage declines occur in Germany, China, and Russia, with a much smaller decline in France. You should note that the declines in several countries, including South Korea and China, will accelerate as the impact of shrinking fertility rates and slower growth in number of children sets in. The next two countries, the UK and Brazil, are projected to see slow growth that turns negative after 2040. And the next block shows two emerging economies, Mexico and India. It's startling to think that these two emerging economies will start to see workforce declines beginning by mid-century or sooner. Finally, there are several large exceptions to the global pattern, of workforce decline. Largely due to immigration, the U.S., Canada, and Australia are projected to see continued, albeit slower, workforce growth over both 20-year periods. That's why how important immigration is. Okay, now this slide shows the drama of China's changing age mix. The solid blue line at the top of the chart shows the arc of workforce growth, with a steep increase followed by a slowdown, then decline. Over the past three decades, the working age population rose by 31%, adding more than 200 million people. But over the next three decades, the working age population is projected to shrink by 200 million. You can see that the steep increase in workers was fueled by the steep increase in the number of children born from 1950 to 1975, and this is depicted in the gray line. Now, after several decades of below replacement rate fertility and fewer children being born, China faces a continued decline in its working age population. This arc of workforce growth is not unique to China, but is happening around the world. Again, a steep increase, then slowdown, and then decline. If you wanted one key indicator of economic growth for a country, I would say look at the arc of workforce growth. Countries each have their own trajectories of growth with different sizes of working age population, different growth rates, and different peak years. So keep in mind China's arc of workforce growth as we turn to the next slide. This landscape of workforce growth shows successive peaks and declines. It is scaled to fit China and India, and it shows key differences across the world's largest workforces, as well as other selected countries. For those of you who've seen my book, you might recognize this graph as the cover. The peaks of China and India, of course, dominate the chart. China's workforce peaked in 2015. You can see that noted at the top, and it's been declining since then. India's peak will be higher and will occur more than 30 years later than China's. So it will be interesting to see what India does to capitalize on this growth. I'll mention a few other parts of the landscape. The countries are layered on the chart to show the successive peaks. So you can read right to left to see the timing of the peaks. Read left to right to see the timing of the peaks. Japan's workforce growth, shown near the bottom in dark blue, has already peaked and is now shrinking. In contrast, the U.S. workforce, shown in light blue, is projected to continue growing, albeit more slowly than in the past. On the right-hand side, you can see Nigeria. Its workforce is projected to more than double by 2050 and then double again by century end. At the bottom, you see that many promising middle-income countries face slower workforce growth over the coming years and will need to quickly adapt. From this landscape and others in the book, you can identify which countries are on the upward, more promising parts of the workforce arc and which are on the downward side. This perspective should inform long-term policy choices as well as investment decisions. While the landscape gives a long-term perspective, this map focuses on growth over the next 30 years and gives you a summary of the UN projections. Europe and Asia in dark blue are projected to see the largest percentage declines, while countries in sub-Saharan Africa in red and orange are projected to have explosive workforce growth. Though shrinking workforces can threaten economic growth, the good news is that the arcs of change are generally predictable. We can see in advance when a country is likely to become vulnerable to its own declining workforce, and there should be time to adapt and adopt appropriate strategies to mitigate the consequences. This simple equation for GDP growth provides a framework for understanding some useful policy ideas. There are two components of economic growth. First is labor force growth, say total hours worked, and second is productivity growth. Productivity growth on the right-hand side refers to increased output per hour. Gains can be achieved through technology, improved production methods, through using higher skilled workers. With a slower growing or shrinking labor supply, there will need to be greater reliance on compensating gains in labor productivity. On the labor force side, I'll mention several ways to increase labor supply. You can increase the number of people in the traditional working age brackets who actually work. That would be an increase in labor force participation. You can increase the number of older workers beyond conventional age range, and you can increase immigration. You've already been hearing about these policy options and will no doubt be hearing more over the coming years as more countries experience shrinking workforces. It is clear that adapting to slower workforce growth depends on more effective use of both human capital and new technologies. So as I come to the end of my talk, I want to review a couple of takeaways. First, explosive growth in Africa will continue. That means that almost all future population growth will occur in Africa. Second, developing countries will age more quickly than the advanced economies did, giving them much less time to prepare. Third, workforce growth is slowing almost everywhere and reversing in many places. New policies must be put in place to address these changes. A first step in adapting to the coming changes is to consider demographic strengths and weaknesses that could be strengths that could be leveraged and weaknesses that need to be addressed. I offer the example of the United States, and I show four competitive advantages that the U.S. can leverage. First, our population is relatively young compared to Europe and Japan. That means we have a relatively large share of young people. We have a growing working age population, and the share of older people is increasing more slowly than elsewhere. We also have a tradition of welcoming immigrants. So with good planning and foresight, these advantages can be leveraged to improve economic and social well-being of all age groups. Here are some ways that we can adapt. I'd say improved education of our valuable youth should be our top priority. Continued and perhaps increased immigration is critical. Another priority is retraining older workers so their skills are suitable for the open positions. Another priority should be to consider what might be done to reduce the increasing healthcare burden of the aging population, in particular, the cost and social burdens of Alzheimer's and other dementias. Finally, the dip in U.S. life expectancy must be addressed. So in conclusion, I hope this talk has given you a helpful perspective on how key demographic drivers and challenges contribute to our changing world. And I hope you are prompted to think differently as you read the news about world events. I suggest in my book that if you understand the demographics of about 20 or so key countries, you'll be able to better understand the forces behind the dramatic changes we are seeing. Most important, I hope my talk has encouraged you to think about how you might use the information for your own planning. Based on what we already know, we can be reasonably confident in the demographic projections. Such projections are not like earthquake forecasts that warn of destructive activity coming within the next 30 years. The dramatic demographic changes we have talked about are not uncertainties. They are unfolding now, not starting sometime in the future. I suggest in my book that everyone, including individuals, communities, elected officials, and business leaders, should have a demographic preparedness plan that anticipates how they will deal with the coming demographic changes. This would include plans for housing, plans for dealing with worker shortages, plans for possible career changes to accommodate longer work life, and plans for long-term care. Such a demographic preparedness plan, unlike an earthquake preparedness plan or a business interruption strategy, would not be an emergency plan. It should be a long-term strategy for adapting to the major changes we know are coming. Thank you for your attention.
I'd like to say great minds think alike. I'm going to ask her a question that I wrote before I heard the end of her speech, her presentation, rather. Actually, I'll skip that and start at the first one. If you were writing the State of California Education Framework, what two important concepts regarding demographic changes would you want high school students to know and understand? If as part of the educational program for high school students,
they should read my book and understand.
Okay, got that. And okay,
they should buy all kinds of copies.
No, okay,
but that's what I think. What the key thing is to understand the differences across countries. That the countries are different and they're driven by the timing and pace of their fertility and life expectancy. And so you can't lump countries together without understanding what makes them look alike. I would say they should pick 20 countries and follow the demographics of those 20 countries and understand them.
Okay. Sounds good. I actually wrote this question, but she already answered it. You wrote in your book just as we have earthquake preparedness plans, we should all have plans for demographic preparedness for adopting what we know is coming, and they are not emergency plans. I guess my question is, how do individuals or families act on that?
Oh well, we all make housing choices. We choose the neighborhoods we want to live in based on a whole variety of things. Maybe one is the house we can afford. But also, you know, we pick schools. We pick attributes of the community. Are there services that we want to take advantage of? Are there people in similar ages as our children or ourselves that we want to have neighborhood associations with? And then, of course, as we get older, there are issues of senior housing and long-term care. And that's a really big issue. So that's and I think the biggest issue of all has to do with aging in place, which sounds really good. If you love your house and you want to stay there, great. But you have to think about, is there going to be labor available? Are you going to be able to get healthcare workers so that's a real issue. And so I think the housing is a key thing in terms of an individual preparedness plan, certainly job choice. What kind of job, what industries, what careers. And then if you believe that this is the golden age of workers, then, you know, you could develop your career strategy in a different way, but also you have a longer career life. I mean, it's going to be a very long working life. So you have to pick some things you really like.
But before I ask any more questions, does anybody in the audience have a question? Let me start here.
I was aware that one country called Bhutan created a measurement called a gross national happiness. I wondered if you could connect happiness in some way to demographics. A way that you could measure. Sometimes population growth may increase happiness. Other times it may be like Nigeria. It seems if it's such a poor country, it seems they're almost like doomed to be more unhappy as you have so many people.
Okay, so I'm not sure I can connect that right now, but I'll give it some thought. But I think what the key thing is that GDP is not the most perfect measure of well-being. And so other measures, whether it's happiness or human development index or some other measures are really important to consider. And I think if we do all these things to improve the GDP. It should improve the well-being, but it's a too narrow a definition of well-being.
On your projections, do you take into consideration, I know you have fertility, but do you also consider mortality rate? Because many poor countries have a much higher mortality rate, and also the increasing effects of climate change.
So two parts of that question. These are the UN projections, so I use them, the UN numbers. And they do have alternative fertility assumptions, so they look at that. And I talked about the life expectancy numbers, which include the mortality rates at different ages. So yes to both of those. In terms of accounting for climate change, the impacts of climate change, I'm not sure the UN has a systematic way of doing that, but what the UN does is they consult with the census bureaus in individual countries to get insights to adjust their own models. And so that would be one way they could do that. But it's very, very, it's not clear how they've incorporated climate change into their models. And I think probably climate change comes in the life expectancy numbers more than it does in the migration numbers.
Do you think China has great demographers and that's why they've invested in Africa so heavily? But actually, what I wanted to ask about is as an economist, you factored in income inequality in these projections, or your data sources factor in income inequality, because I think that is a big part of our drop in life expectancy here in the United States.
I think the drop in life expectancy in the United States is that might contribute to it in income inequality, but the key attributes are the opioid crisis, obesity, and the COVID epidemic. Most recently. We also have, I don't have the numbers offhand, but we have a high maternal mortality rate. And we also have a really shockingly high accident rate for children. And so I was going to say, you know, if you had a budget, this would be a question I would ask for you guys. If you had a budget of the money that you were going to spend, tell the CDC how to spend their money on improving life expectancy in the United States, what would you spend it on? Would you spend it on car accidents, reducing car accidents, obesity, the opioid epidemic, or would you spend it on increasing the lifespan of older people? I'd spend it on car accidents and obesity.
So recently, Bernie Sanders was talking about a 32-hour work week, and in Japan, they have very long work weeks. How would that overlay in your workforce projections about tweaking the hours per week per worker?
So just linking that back to the question about do they have really smart demographers, I would say that that's not being really smart about demography. So I looked into that and I thought, wait, 32 hours? Wait, how does this, how's that going to work? And so the 32 hours is a definition of when overtime kicks in. So anything over 32 hours, you earn overtime. So that was the key part about that proposal. So I'm in favor of increasing wage rates as much as possible. But that was kind of a flawed way to get at it.
I guess on the other side, in Japan, because they work such long hours that we don't, that's another lever as well. They're not breaking over.
Yeah, so that in my equation, that would increase the number of hours worked. But you know, even France is trying to reduce the work week. The Japanese, you know, might be onto something with this because they have a shrinking working age population. They have a shrinking total population, but their income per capita is going up. So they've somehow figured something out there.
Did you have your hand up?
Two-part question. One, does your book cover things that readers should take away as what they can implement in day-to-day life. So, you know, thinking about hiring and bias towards ageism when you're hiring people, right? If there's going to be more older people that are going to be available in the labor market, you know, thinking about HR strategies there. Or if you're buying a house, maybe a ranch-style house may be better because there might be more buyers in the house. So that's exactly. One.
Yeah.
And the second is, you know, Europe, certain parts has covered the safety net, which, but has not really impacted the birth rate, right? So it's like, hey, you know, if things go bad, you know, that's why I don't cannot have too many children, or we should not have too many children, right? So there's a negative model that model is not working on the age, increasing the replacement rate. So is incentivization the only model to increase the replacement rate? Like, have you given that a thought?
Well, so I think what you're asking about is, are there pronatal policies to increase the birth rate? There are tons of pronatal policies that countries have tried, many, and none of them work. So it's really interesting. There are things ranging from Singapore tried the and they can do a lot of things since they're kind of a dictatorship. But so they had this idea that maybe you couldn't get Social Security unless you had two children, because then the Ponzi scheme of Social Security wouldn't be a Ponzi scheme anymore. That was one idea. They also adopted government-sponsored dating services because they wanted – I mean, they realized they wanted more children, but they really wanted more marriages because that was going to lead to more children, maybe. But that's turning out not to be true. Japan – let's see. What did Japan do? Japan did nothing for increasing birth rates. South Korea has all kinds of incentives. They give you favorable treatment in the apartment lottery so that if you have children, you get a higher number or better number. Hungary gives all kinds of cash bonuses and cars and minivans. And so there's like a whole range of these things. And there's no evidence that any of these pronatal policies actually work. And there's some evidence that they work on a temporary basis, like a little blip up, but it's usually that's a temporal shift, like the people who were going to have more children had them sooner to take advantage of the financial incentives or tax breaks or tax credits or whatever. So there's little evidence that it works. There's a lot of discussion about it, and it's a little scary to me because it smacks of eugenics. So we need to be careful. We need to watch for that. But anyway, it kind of boils down to how would you get women to have more children once they become empowered and realize the cost of having children, they're less willing to have more children. Better childcare. It turns out that better childcare may not promote higher birth rate, but it does help more women participate in the workforce. So that's even better. No, the solution, it depends on what you think the problem is. If the problem is a shrinking workforce, more babies is not going to be it's not a viable solution. Immigration is a viable solution, and productivity enhancements are viable solutions. Right. No, it won't lead to replacement rate.
I had a question about China and the projections of the declining birth rate. And it just seems like you're looking at 80 years ahead. And how can the United Nations projections see what's coming up, especially with a communist country with such a strong central government that likes to tell people what to do, maybe. But you kind of just answered that nothing seems to work to increase birth rate. But
well, I think they figured out that they made a really big mistake with their one-child policy, and they've been trying to increase the the birth rate. First, they raised it to two. You can have, now you can have two. Now you can have three. Please have three. But that's not working. And, you know, it's been a few years. There's not been any evidence that it's working. There's still time to make that work. But I think the projections take that into account and factor in. And I only showed one set of projections, and I didn't mean to make it look like these were accurate point estimates, because each one of them has got a, you know, a confidence range around it. And so you can look at, you know, what if fertility, what if they got fertility to rebound? Well, since it's approaching one, rebounding would probably not get it to replacement rate forever. So you can look at the scenarios, and it seems like it's reliable, these projections.
Hi. Getting off the world picture for a moment and just looking at the American picture, I have always been considered myself an older baby boomer, born in 1949. And if you say the baby boom started in 46 or something like that. And the baby boomers have always been described to us as the largest group of Americans, the boom, as it were. They moved through the economy, moved through the schools, remember the building of schools and everything else, and now it's changed. And then there was an article in the New York Times the other day that I read. I ripped out the little graph from it that says, early 30-somethings are everywhere. And they went on to talk about how the largest age groups in America are 30 to 32, and that band has more people in it than any other band. So that's very different than everything that I've experienced. They talk about this in terms of educational opportunities, young jobs and colleges and things like that. So what explained that, and how do you see that as a – is it a local phenomena, a temporary phenomena? How do you see that? It's very apparent in our children's peer groups.
That 30-year-olds are everywhere? I don't know about the not working part. I can't figure out how there could be anybody not working when it's the golden age of workers. Well, just on the baby boomers. So the thing about the baby boomers that's really distinct from the millennials or any other of the generation named groups is that it was really a cohesive group that had similar characteristics. I mean, maybe it was they moved together. The analogy you gave was like the pig and the python. First, they went to elementary school, and then they went to college, and then they entered the workforce. And we had this boom in financial services when they entered the workforce. And now they're aging rapidly. And so you saw that line, the huge increase, and then it leveled off. And they're still powerful. I mean, we have a shortage of healthcare workers, and we have a shortage of retirement housing. It's not big enough for the boomers. I keep thinking that hearing aids will start getting better because the boomers will be more demanding of better hearing aids. But the 30-year-olds, I don't know. I don't know about that. But what the thing that irks me is that the marketers are now saying that these other groups are bigger than the baby boomers. But it's really it's just a marketing thing. You can define the age group to be whatever you want to make it as big as you want. So you can say it's you know, whatever age brackets you want. So unless there's some reasoning behind it, see, the baby boomers were really, it was about the post-war boom. And that economic boom lasted 20 years. And so the baby boomers, the 76 million baby boomers, were all part of that economic boom. And it was all part of the idea that we could have children because we love families and we wanted families, not because we need them to work on the farm. So it was a whole different cultural idea. And now it's just a marketing. I think it's marketing.
We have time for one more question.
For those of us who have lived in the Bay Area for a long time, we've experienced a huge growth in population and all of the things that brings with it. The rush hour disasters, you got to make your reservation to get in Muir Woods. You got to take buses when you go to Yosemite and all of those things. So I'm guessing since I've been here, the population has probably doubled as a guess. Now, with your trends forecasting forward, how long would it take for us to get to back to half the population?
Okay, I want to end with I want to say two things about that. First of all, I'm an economist, so I believe in pricing. So I'm not upset that Muir Woods has a reservation system. And as far as highways goes, I think there should be congestion pricing so that you pay higher tolls for. Okay, so that's the economist in me. But I just want to tell you about recent conversation I had with Paul Ehrlich, who many of you know wrote The Population Bomb. So he's a professor, retired professor at Stanford. And so I've seen him a few times and we talked about my book and his books. And he acknowledges that he was wrong about how disastrous the population growth was going to be. But I do agree that he raised a lot of attention about it, and that was a good thing. But as an economist, I mean, most economists believe that we have the ability to adapt to these things. And he didn't factor in that kind of responsiveness and adapting. But anyway, so I talked with him, and he says, you know, Adele, the ideal population, global population, is about 2 billion. And I said, but Paul, we have 8 billion now. So what do you recommend we do? And literally he said, don't worry, people are going to start dying. And it turned out in the news that week, people were dying in Florida from the heat. But it also turns out that more people die from the cold than the heat. But so he had no solution. And it was, again, the idea of, I'm struggling with, if you really believe 2 billion is the best number, and we have 8, then we got to figure out some way to figure out how to maximize the quality of life given this situation. I don't believe we have an overpopulated planet, but he does. But he doesn't have a solution for it either. So I don't have an idea when we're going to cut the population in half.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Adele. It's been a pleasure to work with you, to be here tonight. I want to thank the audience. I'm sorry we don't have time for everybody to ask a question, but I want to thank you all. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club World Affairs, commemorating its 121st year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.